You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
So just to start off, I just want to ask, why do you see raising wages as a critical step towards lifting children out of poverty?
Well, the Children's Commissioner, their research shows that between 30 and 40% of the children who are in poverty have parents who are in paid work. So that, by definition, is showing that the parents are not earning enough for their household and the children to be out of poverty.
So that's a really curious phenomenon, right? Like when people are actually working often full-time jobs and they're still not earning enough to make ends meet. What are the circumstances in New Zealand that are causing this?
Okay, well, I would say there's three factors. There's definitely wages. The second one is that our rents are so high. We're not only a low-wage economy, we're a low-wage, high-rent economy. So people who are on low incomes are more likely to be renting than owning. And then there's the whole issue of the quality of the rental properties being much worse than if they were owning. And then the third thing, is, and this one doesn't come up all that often, is the technical issue of abatements and clawbacks. So people who are working with or in paid work with children and not earning very much will be in receipt of working for families payments and most likely also the accommodation supplement. And any time they earn another dollar, 25 cents comes, well, as long as they're over the threshold, 25 cents comes off for working for families and 25 cents comes off for accommodation supplement. So while those are very useful tools to help the well-being of families and children, it does mean that when they're combined, low wages, high rents and also the abatements, it becomes much harder for people in paid work if they're not earning high wages to not be in poverty.
Yeah, wow, that's really interesting. I didn't know so much about the abatements thing. That's actually news to me. And I did want to ask about, the working poor. Because I was listening to a podcast the other day, which was looking at not a New Zealand example, but a United States example of public service workers that were living in Silicon Valley. Now, these people were earning like $35 US an hour, which is equivalent to about $55 New Zealand an hour, which is a professional wage, basically. These people were living in cars, in shanty towns and tents and stuff. And we haven't quite seen that with professional people in Aotearoa. But I know that in places like Queenstown and Auckland, there have been concerns raised about retaining people like teachers and paramedics and emergency services staff, nurses. Yeah. Because they're being priced out of the housing market.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's absolutely right. I don't think those people would necessarily count as poor under any measures, but we would, to our mind, we see them as middle class. We don't see them as struggling. And we would expect that that group of people would be saving up, getting a deposit together and buying their own home. But if they're in a kind of pincer movement, that the rents are so high in order to have, if the rents are so high that they're not able to save, then they're permanently in a renting scenario. And that's why I was personally very heartened when the Kiwi Bill reset came out and Minister Woods mentioned that the government was looking at much more institutional arrangements for affordable rents. So I think that is an excellent idea and approach. I've also recently come across this phenomenon concept of living rent, which is the idea that people shouldn't have to work more than 12 hours in a 40-hour week to pay for their housing costs. And while the author, Brendan Harray, was putting it forward in connection with affordable rentals and government involvement in the rental market outside social housing. I actually quite like it as a concept generally, so that even people who had a mortgage were not paying more than you know, 12 hours work.
Yeah, that's a really interesting policy. And I did want to talk about that because a couple of years back, we saw a really strange thing occur when the government actually raised student allowances. So that's for people that, you know, like students receive, I think, like now, I think $330 a week. And that's raised $50. So it would have been like $280 before that, which is, and especially urban centres, really not enough to get by. But when the government raised these student allowances, particularly in Wellington, we saw rents increase by around the exact same amount that the student allowance went up by, which is about $50. So, like, the money that was meant to go to students to increase their quality of life kind of went straight into the pockets of landlords in a lot of instances. So are there any policies or strategies that we really should be thinking about to prevent these unintended consequences from occurring if we do lift wages?
Well, I think it's primarily getting better supply, better housing supply into the market. And in the first stage, while, like, if we think about the teachers and the nurses, ultimately they would ultimately want to be owning their own home, but we need to have a world where either people who won't be able to afford a deposit or just be able to be in a place to put together a deposit can live decently. And that's where the idea of the government, I think, looking to partner with institutions to come up with long-term affordable housing, affordable rentals, because that happens in places like Germany. So it's not weird, shall we say.
Yeah, it's, so it is something which has been done to some extent of success before, right?
Yeah, no, that's right.
Can I ask, what is a fair pay agreement and why does the CTU see them as being essential to establishing fair wages?
Okay, well, we see, a fair pay agreement gives people in an industry the ability, if there's a sufficient number of them, to come together and say, we want to bargain as a collective. And we traditionally, you know, over the last, 30 years, we've seen collective bargaining or people in work being able, coming together to bargain collectively fall. And we've also seen wages fall, particularly in the sort of low wage type area. And the ones that the CTU is most interested in is cleaners, supermarket workers and security guards. So we are really keen for the framework, the legislation to put these in place. It's sort of going on in the background, but we'd love it to go faster, because also recently some work came out from the OECD which looked at countries and who had lots of collective bargaining and who had none, and, well, not none's not quite the right word, but, you know, low levels of it. And they put all the countries pretty much on a spectrum, and we were right out on the far end of countries that really didn't have a high degree of collective bargaining. And we feel that this is particularly important in the low wage areas, the supermarkets, the cleaners and the security guards, to be able to group together and negotiate with employers as a whole. And it's not just necessarily wages that they would be looking to negotiate, it's also sort of terms and conditions. It would be things like guaranteed hours, how people were treated, health and safety, processes like that. So we think it's a good idea for raising the well-being of the people in those industries. And it's not necessarily just the money, it's also the conditions that they're operating on.
In particular relation to children,
yes.
What are the benefits of seeing a wage increase for the earners within a household for the children residing within it?
Well, they have more money to spend on their children. They've got more money for food. They've got more money for what they would call enrichment activities. You know, all the things that the research shows that when more income comes into a household, they become better off. But the caveat I would say to that is that It can't be, the income can't just then go to rents or back to the government in the form of clawing back abatements. So it's kind of like a three-legged stool. But the CTU, I mean, wages is what we're about. So our focus is on getting the wages up while also keeping the other kind of cost impacts, countervailing forces, in mind and keeping track of those as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're an economist, right? So what kind of impact does a wage increase have on the overall economy?
Right, okay. Well, it happens as a few things, and it kind of depends on where the wage increase goes. So if we talk about the low-wage sectors, that group of people, unfortunately, don't save a lot, so it gets spent. So while there might be, say, money come out of one business to pay the wages, that same money goes back into the economy and is spent somewhere else. So particularly in the low wage area, we would see that it's net beneficial for the economy because it's all about redistributing the income that is earned in the economy towards people who currently have the least.
So who benefits from that kind of activity then?
Well, the absolutely the low wage people benefit, and I would say that society as a whole benefits because if we start to live in a community that is more equal, we lose the types of problems that you get from inequality, the health outcomes, or just the sort of general poor well-being that happens when we have a skewed society.
And we do, unfortunately, have some statistics which are heading in directions which...
I think we're there now.
Yeah.
Look at our wealth statistics. It's really not pretty. Yeah.
I can see the direction that some of these statistics are headed in, and it is, for me, quite concerning. So, yeah. Lastly, could we just touch on what the potential impacts of us not addressing this issue in 2020 and beyond could be? What if we neglect taking action here? What could happen in 25 or so years?
Well, it would be more of the same, really. It would be increasingly us getting a two-tier society where there's a group of people who do really well and there's a group who do really badly. And it's not costless. Like someone was saying about the benefit cuts in the 90s, the cost didn't go away. They just moved from the government and society as a whole to individual people who are the least able to bear it. So instead of some sort of risk sharing or responsibility sharing, we've now got a group of people, particularly those on benefits and the lower end of those in paid work, who are really struggling. And I don't think it's good. It's not good for people themselves to be living in such poor conditions, because we're a rich country. We can afford to do this. This is all choices. I was speaking for myself, it's not quite the country I grew up in, and it's really not the country that I want to see for my children and grandchildren.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.